leftist bullshit radio.
Well, then I should be fine.
Oh, absolutely.
No, I mean, like anything, I wasn't going to say, I mean, we're not on, right?
No.
I wasn't going to say, like, cocksucker. But she was like, I don't know how it came up in conversation, but I think maybe she did some research on me, and she found out that once in a New York Times interview, I talked about masturbating in the New York Times. It made it into the New York Times. She said, well, don't talk about that here.
Well, yeah, I don't see too much of a reason to talk about masturbation, but, I mean, unless you really feel the need, and then if I don't like it, I'll edit it.
So well, there you are.
Yeah, but I usually do book interviews, so...
Right. I've read some.
Oh, that's good.
A couple, right?
That's good. I've seen a couple of plays. I've actually seen two of yours.
Really? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, there's this one and Beautiful Child.
I guess I owe you about 4 hours back of your life.
I'll collect. Anyway, all right. Hey, Dev over there, that's the engineer. Do you have SoundForge running? Okay, everything's running. Cool. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Okay, and our levels are set? Everything's cool. All right, you ready?
Yeah.
You ready, John?
I'm ready.
Okay. Da-da-da. Welcome. Well, let me start that.
That's going beautifully. It's going beautifully.
Welcome to Open Book on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is playwright Nikki Silver, who is talking to us from New York. And my other guest in the studio here is director John Dixon. Nikki Silver is author of a new play, Past Perfect, making its world premiere debut at Theater Rhino through May 20th. And John Dixon is the director of that play. John Dixon also directed an earlier play at Theater Rhino by Nikki Silver titled Beautiful Child. Nikki Silver is one of America's up-and-coming playwrights, author of such plays as Pterodactyls, Beautiful Child, Raised in Captivity, a revision for Broadway of The Boys from Syracuse as well, several other plays, The Food Chain. Nikki Silver, let's start with you a little bit. Before we get into this play, a little bit about your history. You were born in Philadelphia but wound up coming to New York to go to NYU, that's correct?
This is correct. I was listening to all that. I'm so too old to be up and coming, but I appreciate the kind words.
Well, you may be too old to be up and coming, but that's more or less where it appears to be, because that's how everybody defines you.
Really? All right. Yeah. Well, God bless them. God bless them.
Well, you could be up and coming at 70. I mean, you know, it doesn't
matter. I look forward to it.
No, you don't. You'll be back at Barney's. Okay, let's start again.
Yeah, I moved to Philadelphia. I was born in Philadelphia, but I left. I went to NYU early admission, that way where you avoid 12th grade, you know, and you get your high school diploma after your first year of college. And so I moved to New York when I was 16.
And at that point, you went right into the theater department there?
I went to what was called, is still called, the Experimental Theater Wing at NYU. Yeah.
And at that point, you wanted to be an actor? So.
I really didn't know. I don't think I wanted to be an actor. I didn't know. I wanted to find some way to have a career in the theater. And the Experimental Theater Wing was very, you know, this is the 70s. I mean, it was 1976 when I was 16. So it was very sort of groovy, and everyone had long hair and ate granola, and people were naked in class all the time. So it was very unstructured in a lot of ways. And since I really didn't know what I wanted to do, that seemed like the right place for me.
At what point...
Except for the nudity part, which I eschewed.
At what point, then, did you try your hand at playwriting?
Well, after I graduated, actually, I wrote a play called Bridal Hunt, my very first play, and it was extremely coarse and filthy and funny. And I'm Jewish, Nikki Silver, and people thought it was anti-Semitic because I wrote about my parents in what I thought was the most honest way I could. And so people thought this was a violent attack against my people. And when I say my people, I don't know what that means. But anyway, and I gave it to a friend of mine who worked as a receptionist at the Phoenix Theater, and I said, see if you think I can be a writer. And she didn't tell me, but she gave it to, like, the artistic director there, and he loved it, and he did a reading of it. And I thought, my career is launched. And then they went out of business about a week later. So my career was not launched, but that's how I got started.
And at that point, you just started writing play after play. How did that work?
Well, I can't imagine this is interesting to anyone but me, and I find myself fascinating, so I'll keep going. I actually, I didn't know. I mean, I had to earn a living, so I worked in stores. I think you know because you must have read my bio. I worked in Barney's, and I worked at a store called Reminiscence, and I was a waiter. But I eventually happened upon someone who had seen the play Bridal Hunt and asked and commissioned a play from me. I think he paid $600, and it was a terrible, terrible play. And he rented this space on 11th Avenue and this theater, and he put it up. And the man who ran the theater said to me, you know, I think you can write, and I can, there are times when I can't rent the theater. Would you like to do plays here when I have no tenant? So, like, twice a year, I would get a phone call saying, usually, because he couldn't rent in August, the dead of summer, and usually around the holidays, it's very hard for him to rent at Christmas. So I would get a call, and he would say, I have 4 weeks open in 6 weeks. So I would sit down and write a play, and I would put it on with my friends, and we rehearsed it. I mean, we all had day jobs, and we paid for the rehearsal space, and we would build the sets, and we would hang the lights. And I directed them. I didn't know any directors. And I did that for, like, 7 years. I probably did between 14 and 20 plays in 7 years. And then I was very, very tired.
I'll bet.
I was exhausted. And some of those plays were just awful. Many of them were quite terrible. But some of them have gone on to have very long lives. Fat Men in Skirts was produced at the Magic Theater, and it was written under exactly those auspices. And all of those plays, we didn't have any money, obviously, so they were all made for very, like, very, very cheap sets, very small casts. So some of them have gone on to great afterlife, and some of them died appropriately at the time. And so I was very tired after, like, 7 years, and I wrote a play. And I thought, I'm not going to do this. I'll send this out. And I really hadn't been sending plays out. I had an agent, but I was too afraid to call him. He was a very nice man, but he looked sort of like the old year. He had a long white beard, and I was mortified of him. And so I sent the play Pterodactyls out, and a bunch of theaters wanted to do it. But the Vineyard Theater didn't say, let's fix it first. They just said, let's do it. They thought it was fine the way it is. They liked the way it is. And it was a big hit.
A couple of questions then. First of all, that's an interesting comment you made. They were the ones who said, don't fix it.
Yeah.
On these other ones, when you'd send them out or talk to people, they'd go, this is good, but you got to do this, this, and this, and the other thing.
Yeah.
And all of which might compromise your own vision.
Exact. My vision, blurred and double as it is, was still my vision. Yeah, and I was, you know, I was 32 at the time by then. I would have made any changes. As a matter of fact, there's an important theater called Playwrights Horizons in New York. You know, they've won a bunch of Pulitzers out of there. And the artistic director at the time, who is no longer the artistic director, said to me, I love the play, but I don't like what was identified as the third act, and I don't think you should have any of those biblical references in it and lose the Brecht poem. And I went home overnight and rewrote the whole play. I was very desperate to get a production, and he still didn't do it. So the Vineyard didn't say any of those things.
So you stayed with the Vineyard, and Pterodactyls was, I think, 1994, is that right? 3 or 4?
I think it was later, but that's okay. I can look it up.
No.
John, and I'll look it up.
No, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's funny in looking up and reading the synopsis.
Yeah, you're right.
In reading the synopsis of Pterodactyls, it's a black comedy about a dysfunctional family of alcoholics with an HIV-positive son and a lot of secrets, which sounds to me a great deal like Past Perfect.
Well, there you are. But I'm such a I'm a very different person than I was then. And Pterodactyls is actually a good deal more abstract. Just its tone, and it's sort of more reckless in its theatricality, and it's a lot more abstract. And what the plays are actually about quite different things,
sure.
But they do have the same initial. If you were just to say, like, what's the plot? Kid comes home. But and Dad isn't dying, of course, in Pterodactyls.
Yeah.
They all die eventually in Pterodactyls. Now I've spoiled it.
No, death actually does play a role. But, you know, in all of your works, we find cannibalism, incest, adultery, AIDS, murder.
You don't find cannibalism in all of my
books. No, in some of them. All right, you're right.
The good ones, right.
Right, in the good ones.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
The question then is, when you're working on a play, how do you bring in the various elements? How does a play come together?
Well, I when I'm asked to speak at classes and that sort of thing, which I think that I am at all is an indictment upon the educational systems in this country, but when I am, I usually have to explain that I think writing is a process wherein you know enough before you start. I don't start until I know a good deal. You know enough so that your unconscious is free to function, but you don't know so much that your unconscious isn't stimulated. So before I sit down, I know what ideas I'm exploring in the play. I know who the people are. I know where it starts. I have an idea of where it ends. It may change. And I have to know a good deal about it. But if I know everything, then there's no unconscious connection. It's just I'm just connecting dots. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's pretty much when I've talked to novelists, that's more or less where the best ones go anyway. They kind of have an idea, beginning and end, but the characters very often almost start channeling them. They speak to you rather than you deciding what they're going to say. Is that kind of similar?
They very much so. They take over. Mm-hmm.
In the case of Past Perfect, then you knew where it was going to begin with these children coming back and their father is dying and they don't get along with their mother. And you kind of knew that we would find out what happens to the father and that there were secrets. Did you know exactly what those secrets were? Did you know?
No.
Did you know at that point that the son would bring home a boyfriend, things like that?
I think I knew that the son would bring home a boyfriend. I have to remember because it's not, you know, it's a little time has passed. But I think I knew that a son would bring home a boyfriend. But I didn't know necessarily what all the secrets were, and I didn't know. For instance, I didn't know that we would have the kind of ghost that we have, you know, in the play and. So there's lots of things I didn't know, but I did know that, I like a play to start with, I like to know where we are, and I like an event, and in this event, it's, of course, Dad's dying, that has brought these people together, who would not normally want to be together. It makes them more interesting. So, but I don't think I knew a whole lot more. Like, I knew who they were, I knew what their problem, I knew he was an actor, I knew she was often married, but I didn't know what all the secrets were, no.
Well,
I didn't know Dad had, should I say it? Won't it spoil
sure.
the suspense? I didn't know Dad had raped Mom, for instance.
Okay. Well, I saw the show, neither did I. No, I'm kidding.
Oh.
Kidding. The next question is, because I don't talk to that many playwrights. I have interviewed Terrence McNally. In terms of the construction of a play, the
uh-huh.
idea of the act one, the act two, in Hollywood they give a big list of things that are supposed to happen in a film, almost, you know, kind of a framework,
uh-huh.
you know, like boy gets girl, boy loses girl, boy re-gets girl, and various frameworks.
Girl? What kind of movie are you going to see? Oh, okay. Go on.
Boy gets boy.
Okay, whatever.
Yes.
No, I'm just talking about a framework. Is there a specific framework in plays that either you have or you were told about?
I was never told about it. I didn't study playwriting. I always felt that doing all those plays at that little theater is how I learned to write the kinds of plays that I like, that I want to see. And I don't think anyone can do more than that. You can't write plays that everyone wants to see. You don't know what everyone wants to see. You have to hope you're representative. So nobody there, I'm sure there are rules written down somewhere, but nobody told them to me. And I have a strong internal sort of sense of structure, I think. Past Perfect is two acts, but for instance, Pterodactyls is three acts, even though there is one intermission. And it has to do with making sure that climaxes are in the right place, that secrets are revealed, that action builds to the right moment. So it's more organic than when I have worked, as they say, in Hollywood, and even. Some of that work was writing, but And there it is much more, I mean, there are 30, on page 30 this has to happen, on page 60 this has to happen, so that by page 90 that has happened. And it isn't, it's much more organic than that, I think. But it ends up happening anyway.
Well, John Dixon here, you've now directed two of Nikki's plays. When you're looking at that, do you see that kind of organic nature? Do you see, how do you view dealing with climaxes or secrets when you're looking at a play like that? Are you almost seeing those same beats, do you think?
It really depends on the material. I think with Nikki's plays, the structure of the writing is so surprising that when things are revealed, it happens in a way that's that is surprising, and so you sort of go, you trust the writing, really. I think Nikki's plays for me are often the most fun to direct, and quite often, not easiest, but easier than most because of how well he structures scene work. And
well, go on.
No, but it's true, Nikki, please.
No, I mean, go on.
And just to correct the record, this is my third Nikki Silver play. Okay. I directed The Maiden's Prayer, one of his earlier plays, several years ago. Well before Theater Rhino and I.
Well, then,
and no one comes home. There's no parents. No one comes home.
No parents, yes.
Well, do you see a difference in his work between that early play and today, then?
Sure. But, again, the style is still structurally the same in terms of, I mean, sure, the evolution has happened, but he's still the master of the monologue. No one writes a monologue like Nikki Silver. And the quick dialogue, his elegant, pared down dialogue is constant throughout. But I think structurally this is a different arc of how the story is told, particularly with the flashback element in Past Perfect. Proved challenging and was a sort of unique thing to have to work through.
You're listening to an interview with playwright Nikki Silver and director John Dixon. Past Perfect, Nikki's new play, is now at Theater Rhino through May 20th. Workshopping is generally the way most playwrights figure things out. This play was not workshopped.
Never did a workshop. I did one workshop in my whole life. Believe in them.
We did a reading at the Rhino, but it wasn't a proper workshop. We just rehearsed for a couple of days and then put it up for an audience just to hear.
I'll do
out
some
loud.
Readings sometimes. I've done readings of plays of mine, but those readings are usually for a theater to hear the play, as opposed to, I don't think you learn anything from a reading, and I don't think you particularly learn much from a workshop. Hey, like them apples.
Well, but how do you feel then? I mean, you were not able to make it out here to San Francisco.
No, and I'm sad about it. But go on.
But that means that, you know, you never actually saw your play produced. Do you even know before the play is seen once whether it's going to work or not? Can you really know that?
I heard the play a couple times in New York. I did do a couple readings here, but so I have a sense of what the play is. But I don't think you know it anyway. I don't think you know it after a workshop. I don't think you ever know it, and I don't think you know it necessarily very much from night to night. Because it's very much a living thing. But you do have a sense of whether or not it's working for you. Can I tell an anecdote?
Sure.
Okay, this will bore everyone to tears. I'm not going to come off very well in this anecdote, but I'll tell it anyway. Years and years ago, before I had any professional productions when I was doing those plays at that little theater, there was a theater in New York called Circle Rep. And they're gone now, but they were very famous. Lanford Wilson came out of Circle Rep, and a lot of great writers. And they had this thing called the Playwrights Project. They invited like 15 playwrights in New York City, and we would meet once a week, and there was a moderator, and you would bring your play, and they provided the actors, and they would read it, and then they would ask to talk about it. And the playwrights would usually say, well, here's what I want to find out from you, or we would just talk about it in general. And I was just as mean as could be to everybody. I remember one person, the opening stage direction of their play said, the stage is a vortex. And when we talked about it 2 hours later, I said, to be honest, I stopped listening after I heard the stage was a vortex because I didn't know what it meant. I mean, is it black? Is it white? What the hell does that mean, a vortex? So when it came time for my play, I brought in pterodactyls. And we read it. They read it. And afterwards, the moderator said, what would you like us to discuss? And I said, nothing. I said, I watched the audience. I can tell when they were bored, when they were interested, when they laughed. I know what made sense to me. I could tell what made sense to them by looking at them. I said, I didn't need to discuss it. So I'm very skeptical as to the whole developmental process.
However, you weren't here to watch the audience opening night.
No, but I did intend to be. I did. I mean, it wasn't.
I watched them for you, Nikki.
Thank you.
Yeah, but
that wasn't by choice, really.
But what happens then? I mean, John, you saw that, and I mean, are you able to say, take notes now and say, you know, Nikki, X, Y, and Z, maybe you might think about. Maybe you might think about making certain changes?
I certainly think if Nikki would be open to that, we haven't talked about the possibility of me offering that kind of feedback at all. I would be happy to if he wanted to do that, Nikki.
I don't think now is the time.
No. Recorded it on the radio.
But
no,
in general, were I there, I would have been probably making minor changes.
Right.
I can't imagine I'd say, let's cut that character. But, I mean, you do usually in previews, you know, cut things and rearrange things a little bit. But I wasn't there. But I think whenever John has asked me even something, I've generally responded. I mean, he hasn't asked me to make real changes, but even when he's asked me my take on something, what I think about something, I've generally said, this is what I think, but I don't know that it's the law or the rule, or you decide what you look at and tell me what you think.
One of the best things that Nikki said to me when I asked him a question about a character, he said, let the actor decide that. And I thought that's such a great thing for a writer to do, to say, yes, here's the structure and here's my story, but it's nothing without the actors giving life to the characters.
Well, then at that point, of course, it would be a different production if things aren't absolutely clarified in the text. A different production, two different productions, and one, the production could be a real hit and a great play, and the next it could be an absolute disaster.
Sure, I think that also depends on the take the director has on the piece.
Yeah.
For me, this play, yes, it is hysterically funny, but it's a drama more than anything. And I think for me, I turned the corner of the production when I accepted to myself and to the producers when I said, you know, this isn't a comedy. It's
right.
Very funny. It's hysterically funny. But let me direct the play and not a genre. So as soon as that was made clear to me and I accepted that, the play changed and I think the production grew because of that.
Well, I know that with comedy, because of timing, I mean, Michael Frayn once told me that he saw a production, you know, in the outback of England of Noises Off where nobody laughed, you know, which was kind of frustrating for him.
Right.
But in a drama, usually there's a little bit more to guide you, isn't there?
In terms of what?
In terms of whether something works or not.
I guess so. I consider myself a comedy director. That's sort of where I find myself most frequently, and so I gauge the response of the audience in the laughter. So I did a proper drama last fall, and it was so frustrating to me because no one was laughing. It wasn't funny, so they shouldn't be laughing, but you can always rely on Nikki's plays to bring laughter regardless of what they're a drama or a comedy.
I think I've written two comedies. I've written mostly a lot of very grim plays with a lot of jokes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now, when you
Food
go...
Food Chain is a comedy.
What?
Like a play, like Food Chain is a comedy.
Right.
But for the most part, I don't think I write comedies. I write very grim, serious, sad little plays with a lot of jokes.
Well, what happens to you, Nikki, if you go see a production and it's like Michael Frayn's reaction, nobody
it
laughs?
It happens
or...
constantly.
Really? What do you
and
do?
What do you do? You put a big, insincere smile on your face and you go, thank you all. You've all worked so hard. Thank you so much. And when you give your interviews, you say, wasn't it wonderful? Because they did their best. I've had plays, I mean, particularly in Europe, and I've gone to see a lot of productions of plays of mine in Europe. Fat Men in Skirts, which did not do well at the Magic Theater, ran for 3 years in Berlin. I thought it was the most vile thing I ever saw, but it was a big hit. The Germans loved it, so I couldn't bear it. But you smile and you go, oh, thank you. I'm so glad you liked it. That's what you do.
How about the revision of The Boys from Syracuse? How did that go? That did not get great reviews.
I did fine. I did just fine. Reread them. but the production didn't get very good reviews. It was a very cursed idea to begin with. There had just been sort of a concert version of Boys from Syracuse that the press had loved. So they really didn't care what we had to say. And my contribution, which was perfectly well liked, was very minimal. I really just revised things. It was really fun. I did it because There are so few real big musicals, and the gestation for a big musical is literally 5 or 6 years. So when The Roundabout called me and said, "Do you want to revise the book, and we're going next season," I thought, well, this opportunity will never happen again. To have a big orchestra and be at rehearsals with dancers, and that it was fantastic fun. But it was not a stellar production. So no one's fault. Everyone stunk. They were all lovely people. I put a smile on my face and I said, "Thank you. You all did your best, and it was lovely."
Did you know when you were looking at the previews what was going to happen?
I knew at the first day of rehearsal.
Really?
Yeah, sure. I knew when I said yes. Pretty much. I knew through casting. I knew during the casting process. This was doomed. But I also knew, and this was the case, that the book writer is generally not beaten up. And certainly the person who revises the book certainly isn't beaten up. In a revival, it's the director who usually takes it on the chin, and did in that case. And he's gone on to have, Scott Ellis is a big success. That was not his shining moment. But I knew that I wouldn't get in trouble, career-wise.
Recently you acted in one of your own plays, right?
Well, I was on stage spouting lines previously written. I don't know whether I was acting. The other actors may disagree with you. But, yes, I appeared in a play of mine.
Did you want to throttle the playwright at any point? Or?
No, I loved him.
I hear you were sleeping together.
We were sleeping together. I loved him. He's not very attractive, but he's kind and he's droll.
Well, Nikki Silver, you were also in a film called Curtain Call.
You have done... I feel like I'm with James Lipton. Except you haven't told me how fantastic I was in Curtain Call. Curtain Call, I have 4 days worth of work, nothing in Curtain Call. I was a replacement. I'm friends with John Cameron Mitchell, who made the film Hedwig. And he was supposed to be in it, and he got sick. And it was it wasn't a tiny independent movie, but it wasn't a big studio movie, and it was shooting in New York. And they called me up, and he called me and he said, "Could you go in tomorrow and be in a movie for me?" And I said, "I don't think so. First of all, when you're in a movie, you have to shave like twice a day. It's very annoying." And I said, "Who's in it?" And he said, "James Spader." I said, "I don't think so." He said, "Polly Walker." I said, "I don't think so." He said, "Sam Shepard." I said, "Well, that's a little more interesting." "Buck Henry." I said, "More interesting." Michael Caine. I said, "Well, oh, go on." And he said, "Maggie Smith." And I said, "What time do I get there?" I never even got to meet her. But I'm in a movie with Maggie Smith. So I live in mortal terror that someone will see it, I showed up for work in a suit, not like with a vest and tie, because that's how I dress most of the time. And the director, whose name I can't remember, Yates, and he was very old and very British. And he said to me, I was just going to wear it in that scene because I was a last-minute replacement. And he said, "Well, you wouldn't wear that, would you?" And I said, "These are my clothes." And that was the tone of the day.
And it didn't seem to get much of a release.
I think they put it out like on flip books that you buy at airport lounges or something. I don't think it was released at all.
How sad, a Maggie Smith film.
I know.
Nikki Silver, changing the topic, getting serious for a second. I also interviewed Tony Kushner along the way. Do you think a writer has any responsibility beyond, pushing out their own angst, any responsibility to society?
No more than any other human being. I mean, you have a responsibility to society to do the best you can, to be a kind person, to stand up for people who are abused. But I don't think a writer has any special responsibility because of the nature of his work, no. I'm glad Mr. Kushner does, because it has provided us with some very thrilling theater. But I don't think so.
When you're working on a play and you're working on the dialogue, okay, is the dialogue that you're working on, is it pretty much the unconscious, or what goes into the polishing of dialogue?
The first pass of dialogue can be very unconscious and is written very quickly, often. If I know what a scene is about and what the two characters want, and usually I do, or I wouldn't be at the scene, then it can go very quickly, and it's usually very sloppy because I think it faster. I'm a very bad typist and a very bad speller. And then it'll be two or three more passes before I even think of it really as a first draft of a scene. And John can tell you, I've been known, I said, I'm sending a script, it has 43 changes, I bet you can't spot any of them. I mean, I move the word the, and I decide this shouldn't be an apostrophe S, it should have the word is. I reread the dialogue over and over and over and over and make very tiny changes that are almost imperceptible.
Do you read the dialogue aloud to get a sense?
Most of the time.
And John, at your point, okay, you get the dialogue, and you do a first run-through. At that point, when you're doing that run-through, what's going on in your mind as you're watching the actors?
In terms of
what they're doing.
He's thinking of lunch.
I'm thinking of paychecks. I am looking to them to bring their to bring the roles to life. Casting for me is the biggest job you can do.
Well,
to pick the right cast.
In this particular case, what did you have to work with? Obviously, it wasn't a final draft, or was it?
Of the play?
Yeah.
I approached it as a final draft.
Okay.
Nikki said, if you have questions, please call me. If there are train wrecks, please let's discuss them. But for me, that was the final draft, the script that we went into first rehearsal with.
And for the most part, it was. So at the point that you've selected the actors, that's the point where you're just going to trust them with whatever they're going to do?
Yeah, certainly.
And so what happens to your job? Is it mostly just blocking at that point?
No. It's I certainly have ideas about what the character should be and the arc of the experience. Actors quite often will immediately go to an extreme. Take, for example, Clayton's character, Seth.
Okay.
Clayton, I wanted to play him very sort of fey and big, and it was good for him to experience that, but ultimately wasn't how the character ended up. There are flashes of that, and there are samplings of that kind of character type, but the character was more than just that. So if I would have just let him go, he would have been playing this hugely fey character and not had a sense of realness about him.
Well, Nikki, when you're working with a character like
someone
that,
else was talking, I drifted. What? Go on.
Okay, let's start. Nikki.
Yes.
Nikki Silver, when you're working with a character and you're developing that character's dialogue, how much of the character's history beyond the play do you actually know? And then, John, at your end, does any of that information come to you, or do you invent an entirely different, or the actor invent an entirely different history? So, Nikki?
I would say I have, by the time I've finished a draft, I know everything about every character. And when I say I know it, I mean I have my histories. Unless they create a problem, I would never impose them on a director or an actor. I would say choose what works best for you. But I have a very strong sense of who they are and their background, where they went to school, if they went to school, and their sex lives and parentage and everything. But I wouldn't discuss it with an actor. And usually if they ask me a question, I'll say, well, what is the most fruitful answer for you for you? What's going to, you know, work for you in terms of conflict?
Yeah, I would mirror what Nikki said, and I love that he has done that in real time for us. When Clayton and I had lunch with Nikki several months ago before the play started rehearsals, Clayton asked some very specific questions, and Nikki said just that to him. Pick the best thing that gets you from point A to point B. And that's what something I really admire so much about Nikki is there's not an ego he's not precious. He doesn't hold the arc of the story in this high regard that is not flexible.
So in that sense, there's an understanding by playwright, actor, and director that this is mainly a collaboration.
Of course, it's a collaborative art form, and from the playwright to me to the
but
actor.
But I'm very precious about the actual language.
Of course, no, and I'm just we're talking mostly backstory and things that aren't literally represented in the play.
The actor has to find the intention that works best for him and the history that works best for him, and when I say him, I mean them, her, whatever. But don't screw up a word. An actors are human beings, and they screw up words all the time, and I'm very understanding. I've never yelled at an actor. But don't intentionally change. Don't go changing language without discussing it.
Well, then, have you ever thought about, say, writing a novel or a short story where you wouldn't have to have that collaboration?
I really can't even read anything longer than a recipe, so I can't imagine I would have the patience to write a novel.
Well, back 10 years ago, you said, I don't like most plays, and a lot of plays are boring.
That was 20 years ago. But I feel that way again. I went through a period where I liked them all, but feel that way again. You missed my holly-go-lightly effervescent period, and I'm back to my dour curmudgeon period.
I also have an interesting quote from you. Jews eat while wasps drink, which is certainly reflected in this play where the wasps all drink.
Well, I think I did say that, I guess, probably during Food Chain, which is a play all about eating in some interview. But, I think it was because... Also, someone asked me, I have written Jewish characters, but I don't tend to write Jewish characters. I tend to write waspy characters. And someone said to me, do I think there's a big difference? And I said, well, Jews eat and wasps drink. And this is just something I've observed. We didn't drink in our family, but we ate, man. Ethnic people tend to eat.
Right. But certainly using alcohol is a way for characters to... spill out their angst is a tradition that certainly, you know, you could see it in Tennessee Williams. You could certainly see it, God knows, in Eugene O'Neill. You could see it in Edward Albee as well. I mean,
you haven't mentioned a Jew.
Well, I don't recall much drinking in Arthur Miller.
I'm not saying
there's a little drinking in Angels in America, I think, somewhere in there.
I'm not saying that, you know, for instance, I'm drunk right now, but most Jews eat while the wasp, particularly in the face of tragedy. I remember during the AIDS, early days of the AIDS crisis, and people were dying, and my waspy friends all sat around drinking, and their parents all drank, and I would just eat. I would just eat. Felt better.
Well, I love the drinking over the eating. It's much easier to stage.
Yes, and cheaper in the long run.
Yes, exactly.
And now a broad question for both of you. Nikki Silva, where do you see drama in America today?
You mean artistic drama? As
sure.
Opposed,
yeah, well, I mean, you know.
Because I enjoyed watching the Gonzales hearings. I thought they were dramatic. But that's probably not what you meant. I would say drama today is, I actually think it's the theater is in a bit of a sorry state. I think that audiences have diminished and we haven't, everything goes in cycles. And when I got to New York, it was a very experimental period and plays were, I think, more daring, in the 70s and in the 80s, and as things got more expensive, plays got safer and safer and safer. There are virtually no plays on Broadway now. Everything is off Broadway, and so that's picked up the slack, and so that's had to become, is that correct grammar? That has been forced to become more safe, and so I think now this has been a blessing to a lot of regional theaters because writers do go to regional theaters when they wouldn't previously, and I think while people decry television and there is such an enormous amount of absolute detritus, I feel so classy having used the word detritus, feel there's an enormous amount of slop, that's more like me, on television, there's also, I think, some of the best writing going on television. I think The Sopranos and I look at the credits of TV shows and I see Eric Overmyer and I see people who really are playwrights first. And while that's great for TV, it's not so good for the theater.
That's what I'm seeing as well. I was talking to a very good writer named A.M. Holmes the other day, and she's working on a project for HBO at this point. I mean, I think that seems to be the direction. Have you thought about moving in that direction yourself?
I have done some television. I enjoy television. I live alone and have three of them. But I don't like flat-screen TVs. I think plasma and LCD, I think it's a myth. But go on.
Okay, John Dixon, let me ask you the question about theater now, since you are working in a regional theater.
I would agree wholeheartedly with Nikki that because of the Disneyfication of Broadway and then trickling down from there, it's just so expensive to get anything done that people are sacrificing the art, and we are losing writers to mediums that can pay them better, frankly. And it's a sad state to feel you're part of a dying art form.
So. Well, also, I know it's his time, but I just want to say, what's sad to me particularly is how safe everything has to be now.
Yeah.
Everything has to be linear and sort of kitchen sinky and safe. And that's boring to me as an audience member, but that's what everything has become. Go back to John. I'm done.
No, I think that's... I hate safe plays, and I don't like to do them. So when a play like Past Perfect comes along that isn't safe, that does screw with time and place, and people say things that you're not supposed to say to each other, particularly people that you've given birth to, I think that for me is those exciting experiences are pinnacle.
And it's also amazing because the unsafe plays are either coming back in revivals like Virginia Woolf, or they're by Tom Stoppard, and they do get the good reviews and the audiences. It's there. I mean, the audience is there, and I think the people want it, but somehow the money people are not letting it happen.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to bite the hand that I hope someday will feed me, so I do think that the general critical atmosphere in New York has become downright malignant.
Go on.
Well, but I love the people at the time.
No. Well, in a more general sense, define what you mean by malignant.
I think that there was a time, I remember, again, I'm going back to the years that formed my aesthetic, when For Colored Girls Who Considered Suicide was on Broadway. First of all, that wouldn't happen now. And Pacific Overtures had just opened. And I remember the New York Times Review very clearly, a sentence in it, because it's something that I've always remembered as important. And it describes the show as attempting to soar. And it doesn't always manage it. In fact, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, in fact, sometimes it falls with a thud. But it always attempts, and that's thrilling to watch. We really don't, the critical atmosphere, and that was the critical atmosphere, was trying something exciting and daring and new was worthwhile. Now, the general critical atmosphere in New York, which does trickle out through the country, because if New York puts a stamp on something, that's the stamp it has. And the general critical atmosphere in New York seems to me to be much more simply consumer advocacy. You'll like this, you won't like that. But more than that, destructive, catty and destructive, as opposed to supportive of the genre, of the form itself, that this is good for the theater. Even if this play doesn't quite work or that musical doesn't quite work, it's an exciting thing because they're trying something so new. That seems to be gone. Now, because maybe it's because it's so expensive, they simply say, it doesn't quite work, and so you should save your money.
The sad thing is that which is safe is usually that which flops. It's really, it's a contradiction. I mean, you can't soar unless you're willing to thud. Right?
I could name some safe things that have been hits, but I'm not going to because I want to project love to all mankind.
Well,
I gave money to a homeless person just today.
Nikki Silver, do you plan on taking Past Perfect to New York at some point?
At the moment I'm writing my obituary and it's dated for a week from tomorrow, so I try not to look too far in the future.
Don't look to the future for the Past Perfect, right?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Past Perfect is playing at Theater Rhino in San Francisco, 16th Street near BART through May 20th. People want information, they can go to therhino.org, or the box office is 415-861-5075. That's 415-861-5075. Any chance of, if there's an audience, it'll be extended?
That certainly is a possibility, yeah. We're hoping if it goes like crazy that we will have at least a two-week extension at the end.
And Nikki Silva, you working on other plays? You have anything else coming up?
I'm working on something at the moment, but not a play.
Which you're not
so
going to go further.
I'm not going to go further. Exactly. Well, nothing, you know. But I mean, I'm working on something, but it's not a play at the moment. But I'm always, you know, one has to always be working on something, or you know, inertia overcomes you and you just turn into a big old blob. I would like to apologize. I feel I talked way more than John, and I'm sure he's more interesting.
Oh, hardly, Nikki.
No, I apologize to in public to everyone.
Good, I'll edit that. All right.
What do you mean? I meant it.
I know. All
right. How long? This interview is going to be 4 minutes, isn't it?
No, it's going to be 28 minutes, but I'm going to, so I have to edit down. Let me do an outro. You've been listening to an interview with Nikki Silver, whose most recent play is Past Perfect, now at Theater Rhino, and John Dixon, the director of the play. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover. All right, that's it.
Excellent. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you, Nikki, and thanks for doing this. Sometime maybe be great to meet you at some point.
I'm sure it would be a great.
We're still trying to woo him to come to see the play.
I think he should.
How is it going, John?
It's fantastic, Nikki. The opening was phenomenal, and
that Jewess, the press agent.
The Jewess.
Oh, I've known Lisa. I've known Lisa for years, and I could tell you things, but not while that CD is running. So if you want to stay on for a minute.
Say that because like one of the first things she said to me was, "Are you a member of the tribe?" And I was like, "What tribe?"
Oh, Geduldig. Geduldig was she used to work here, and I knew her years ago.
I'm sure she is the gem of the sea. But what I was saying was, she tried to send me links to reviews or at one that came out already, and I was like, she said, "If you want to read it, if not," and I emailed her back. I like to avoid them. Usually they're unavoidable, but now they're actually quite avoidable. Since they're not all over the place around my home, you know.
Right.
I don't want to know.
Well, the Cron gave it a good review.
Yeah.
Cron liked it.
That's what she said. But I'm generally not a person who ascribes to that hideously stupid theory that if you believe the good ones, you have to believe the bad ones. I certainly think you can believe the good ones and dismiss the bad ones as addle-brained hogwash. However, I have many late nights gone online and done like searches for, I'll do a search for a play like Raised in Captivity. Raised in Captivity won awards. It was a really important play in my career, and it did phenomenally well. And I'll go and I'll see the review by a production being done by like the volunteer fire department of Oklahoma City. And the critic will actually say things like, Nan Smith's haberdashery does what she can with the incredibly thin part, and then they'll be really mean about me. I'm like, oh, good in Himmel.
Well, that's
so
okay.
I have to read them.
That's okay. The ones that I like are the ones that happen in the Chronicle, where somebody is doing a revival, and what you get is a critical assessment of the play that they're doing, as if the author were actually still alive and around
right.
to hear it. It's like, hello, you know, but. Hey, that's theater reviews, and it's interesting what you say about the Times, because the first review, the Pacific Overtures, was Frank Rich.
You looked it up that fast?
No, I just happened to know that Frank Rich was doing the reviews at that particular time. Come on, I also interviewed Frank Rich. He's a nice guy. I like him. I've never met Ben Brantley, though.
Well, Ben Brantley, I'm actually not quite so much referring to Ben Brantley, because Ben doesn't review that much anymore. I mean, Ben is the only critic at the Times who's ever reviewed me. He gave me my career. He's given me some bad reviews. He's never been catty. He's always been supportive. And he's generally very positive.
Isherwood?
Isherwood is scary. I think Isherwood's going to kill the theater in New York. I think he's going to kill it. Isherwood is like, to be perfectly blunt about it, Isherwood is like a bitchy queen who has to show that he's smarter than everyone else. Well, you want to know something? Fine, go be smarter than everyone else. But root for the industry. Be a cheerleader. It doesn't mean you have to, you can hate everything, but just try to do it with some professional kindness. You know, it's not necessary. We got rid of John Simon from any position of power, and I think he's worse. Someone like, do you know, the Daily News, the woman, the only female critic we have, Linda Weiner.
Right, yeah.
I think she's...
Newsday. Linda Weiner's Newsday.
I think she's the exception. Yeah. She hates things, but you can tell she loves the theater, and she's not there to impress people. She's supportive, honest, she says what she doesn't like, you know. But I'm really scared of what Isherwood is doing to the atmosphere in New York.
Well, Isherwood follows in the Times tradition of Michiko Kukutani, who, as a book reviewer, is every bit as vile as he is. That's just my opinion, you know.
And there's also no, I mean, to be honest, I don't mean to go on and our interview is over, and I wouldn't have said this on tape.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right? Of course I have it, and I'm going to give it to John. He could distribute it, but go ahead.
There's no sense of proportion.
Yeah.
They go after actors and writers as the same way they go after, you know, a 20th Century Fox $200 million movie. These are just people. When we did Boys from Syracuse, which did lay a big egg, and I was really unscathed, but it laid a big egg. And the venom, though, directed at us because we were daring to update. We're trying to earn a living. Rogers, Mary Rogers, who owns the estate, said, update it and hired us and paid us. We did what we were told to do. We're not, you know, MGM, for God's sake. We're like theater artists trying to eke out a living, you know, get some sense of proportion. So it's very annoying.
On that note, I have to go back to the city, Nikki.
Okay, I have to go, too. Goodbye, everyone.
Take
right,
care.
Bye.
Bye.
I think it was fun.
Yeah.
He's so witty. I love him.
Yeah.
He talks like his play is an agent here.
Michael was in there going, and I'm thinking, you could shut this thing off.
Walk me back here for a second.
Okay.
Thanks for cutting him off.